Very happy to have this chance to describe Transformers to you. Helen, do you want to say hello, or you're just going to wait till it's here?
Yeah, hi, I'm Helen. I'm a grad student at Penn. Also happy to be here.
Great. So Helen's doing amazing things with supernovae data and time domain data in general. So we'll be describing, you know, the most of the talks, first me, then Helen, will be about just how transformers work. And I'll talk a little bit about large language models, which is, you know, ChatGPT, because that's why they were, you know, why they became popular. And then Helen will describe briefly applications to time domain data, and we'll also cover image data. So we'll cover the two main types of applications in astronomy. Let me start sharing screen. What do you see, Neil? Is it unobscured or you're muted?
Oh, sorry. It looks good.
Okay. So our key co-conspirator is Dimitrios Tanoglidis, who was a Penn postdoc and is now at Walgreens AI. So he really started the notes that led to what we posted on the archive. And what we posted on the archive is neither a review nor a research paper nor a blog post, but something between a blog and a review. So today we'll begin with an intro to deep learning and applications in astronomy. Just a few minutes, because I know that Perimeter has some amazing theorists who may or may not be familiar with this world. Then we'll talk about attention, which is the mechanism that the transformer deep learning architecture is built on. Then transformers, the LLM ChatGPT bit, we actually won't talk much about. Sorry, my cursor is getting obscured with this damn Zoom thing. Okay, that's better. And then we'll get to applications in astronomy. Feel free to interrupt me at any time. So what's machine learning? It's fitting functions to data. So you have some input data, you have some output task, and you fit a function to it using an optimizer, which is a process of learning. And that process is done by coming up with a loss function that's minimized as you do training. So there's various terms in machine learning. There's just a few of them that I'll explain on this slide and the next one. What is an activation function? The input data is put through a nonlinear function. And a loss function is the thing that, as I said, you minimize as you train. So what's deep learning? Easier to see via an example. A neural net architecture with many layers and many free parameters is an example of deep learning. Supervised learning is, you know, in astronomy, a very easy example is given a galaxy image, is it a spiral or an elliptical? That's an example of machine learning, where machine learning can be used. And the way you'd use it is that you'd have 1,000 or 1,000,000 images in which astronomers have labeled them spiral or elliptical. And you would train your deep learning architecture until it gets those right, and then apply it to new images. ChatGPT is a self-supervised deep learning architecture, which means that ChatGPT is shown millions of sentences, and it's asked to guess missing words in the middle of sentences, and it's trained until it gets that right almost every time. So it's able to then generate new text. And in that process, you don't need a human to explain anything to ChatGPT. It learns it all by itself. So we'll talk a little more about large language models in a few minutes. Any questions so far? So everything begins with a neural network in deep learning. So this is a neural network where the input is the details of a house, area, bedrooms, distance to the city, how old it is, and we want to know what the price of the house will be. So you take these four numbers, you multiply them by some weights, and then you stick them into the node of a neural net, and it outputs the price. The simplest version is the equation above, where it's just a linear sum of these four inputs. What's usually done in a neural net is that you add a constant. So the weights are called weights. The constant is called a bias. And you operate on it with a nonlinear function that typically looks like the sigmoid, so that the response can be very sensitive to the input in some nonlinear way. And you train these free parameters, the W1, 2, 3, 4, and B, in the training process until you get a reliable price. Make sense? So that's a basic neural net. Deep learning involves what I call hidden layers, which is nothing more complicated than the simple version shown below, where instead of the input data going to a single node, which produces an output, you have an extra layer where you can have any number of nodes, two here, and each of them produces an output, which is again multiplied by weights and fed to the final output node, which produces your output. So deep learning adds many hidden layers.
I have a question. Sorry for interruption. So sure. Yeah, actually concerning your previous slide rather. So how sharp is the distinction between supervised and unsupervised learning? So in the example you give, ChatGPT is also trained on kind of human sentences, right? So kind of we know that the sentences are correct. So again, we feed some material, basically, yeah, in supervised case, you feed these two data sets with elliptical and spirals, and you say which one are ellipticals, which one are spirals, right? It looks to me like in the case of language models, you also feed in something which you say, this is correct, right? Or there is some really like deep distinction here.
So ChatGPT is actually self-supervised. What you're referring to is the human reinforcement learning, which is optional. You could have a perfectly functioning ChatGPT that might be racist and full of biases, but it doesn't need humans to produce pages of grammatically correct text.
I understand, but to get to these grammatically correct sentences, it had to absorb grammatically correct sentences in the first place. I mean, No matter what content is, but, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
In which sense is it different from the example with galaxies?
That, suppose you train ChatGPT on all of Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to tell it anything about the Wikipedia text. You don't need to say, this is a noun, this is a verb, this is scientific text, this is historical text, this is a comma, this is a quotation mark. You don't need to tell it anything. It just sees the text. And if you have a sentence, mm-hmm. the sun is rising in the east,
mm-hmm.
you block out the word rising.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, guess what this word should be. And you keep penalizing it until it gets it right.
Yes.
Okay, so no human, all that is done in an automated way. So you're right that humans are used for ChatGPT I'll say a little bit more than I was intending to right now. So the model is statistical. So, it has a ranking of words for any particular, whether it's a masked word or new text, it picks words from a histogram. Mm-hmm. And it picks them at the most popular ones, you know, the highest ranked ones. So the human training tells it that it'll generate a whole paragraph, and then humans will say, okay, that's racist. Mm-hmm. So there'll be sort of an additional loss function, mm-hmm, where, mm-hmm, it will learn not to generate racist text. Mm-hmm. And there's an extra optional layer. But as a machine learning task, it's not necessary.
I understand. So that becomes kind of, in this way, that becomes partially supervised in a sense, right? When it gets this, that gets this feedback, right? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, right, actually, so, Sergey asked a pretty legitimate question, like what the difference is between self-supervised or like unsupervised and supervised learning is. And like while Boop was answering, I was like trying to also compute like what my answer would be. And I think my answer is that, like, when you think about supervised learning, there's usually some kind of like input. So like, for example, like text could be like an input, and then maybe an example of a supervised learning with, an example of supervised learning with like natural language is like sentiment analysis. So you're like, oh, this is a negative statement. Like this review is a negative review. This review is a positive review. So the content of the review is the input, but then like there's some kind of label saying like this is a negative review or this is a positive review. And like the difference between that and this like unsupervised or self-supervised paradigm that like we're talking about is that it's true that there is some kind of like objective, like it's like you want to be able to predict the next word correctly, which does seem kind of like a supervised paradigm. However, the next word is part of the input. So there's no like external label that you're trying to like get correct. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like saying, yeah, like if you have an image and you block out part of it and you're just trying to like reconstruct that part of the image accurately, then that would also be self-supervised because there's no external label that's like, this is a dog or this is a cat, or like the label is sort of like inside the input itself, if that makes sense.
I see. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm still confused. So is that the difference is that one is that you have dynamical feedback from external agents throughout the process versus one is all provided as an input and there is no intervention in the middle?
That's a good question. I think I would say that the dynamical feedback is like a paradigm, but it's, I guess, like less talked. I guess we can kind of like ignore that possibility for now. So the difference between supervised and unsupervised learning is just like the type of data that you put in. So like even during supervised learning, typically it's not like a person goes in and is like, you're wrong, you're right, you know, that kind of thing. But it's more like a priori someone, or maybe even like an automated mechanism, will go through and be like, this image is represents a cat, this image represents a dog. And then when you feed in this data to the neural network that you're trying to train, you feed in a pair of this input and then the label, right? So like the label comes from some kind of external source, which is what I was trying to, like, that's, I guess, what I was trying to express as a response to Sergey's question, is that the difference is that in this case, the label comes from an external source, whereas in the case of self-supervised learning, the label is like the input itself. So yeah, typically there's no like human in the loop. It's all like fully automated, but the difference is just the type of data that you are able to like to give the model. Does that make sense?
I think I got it. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Awesome.
Thanks a lot, Helen. So I just have a few more slides that I'll go through quickly about just deep learning and astronomy in general. So, you know, why is deep learning being used increasingly in astronomy and transformers in particular? You know, one simple thing is when the data size exceeds a certain amount, then you have to automate. Machine learning and deep learning are more flexible, computationally tractable often. And three areas that you can keep in mind are time domain astronomy, which is sequential data, just like words and sentences, galaxy images, and cosmology, which is like you can think of as stochastic images, 2D or 3D. So, you know, you can address questions like galaxy clustering. There's no mathematical answer to how to fully characterize a clustered versus a random distribution. So that's an opening for deep learning. Lensing mass maps have a bunch of information. We don't know exactly how much it is, but the deep learning version of doing cosmology with lensing, this is my last motivation slide, is that you train a deep learning architecture with thousands of simulations that look like this, projected mass maps, in this case labeled with omega matter and sigma 8. Then you show it an observed mass map, sorry, different color scheme and different resolution, and say, which one is it? And it says, well, it's closest to this one. And then you figure out a way to draw contours for your posterior. And, you know, this is an interesting area that people debate about how robust it is and how powerful it is, but it's happening. So let's talk about transformers. Okay, so that was kind of a random introduction. Now we'll talk about transformers based on this review that we put out. And the first thing to do when talking about transformers is what we've been discussing. What is a large language model? It's something that can fill in words, translate text, generate entirely new text, that, as we know from ChatGPT, is mostly correct. So when done via deep learning, the large language model typically knows nothing about syntax, grammar, word meaning. It just learns it from all the text. So the first part in understanding how transformers work is that every word is represented by a vector in some abstract space. So for example, in common usage in English, there are 20,000 words that are used. Each of those, if you were to build your own LLM, you would represent each of those in some, let's say, 100-dimensional space. And in that space, like sun and east and rising would be clustered together. Of course, rising would be clustered with many other words. So how to place these words in the embedding space is a non-trivial task that can itself be learned. But let's say there's a first step. Word to vec is one of the algorithms to do this. You convert each word to some set of real numbers. The large language model then learns these relationships between words, and it learns them pairwise. So later on, I'll show you that one way to think about transformers is it's building the covariance matrix between these 20,000 words with respect to each other. So now let's go through some of the math to see if we can get a feeling for why this magic happens. So the mechanism that that transformers use is called the attention mechanism. And the basic version of it can be written down in just these three equations. So suppose you have capital T words. So you can think of these as the 20,000 common words of English. And each of them is embedded in this 100-dimensional space. So you have this 20,000 by 100 dimensional space of input data. And this equation shows one word at a time. You're transforming the set of input word to an output, sorry, input embedding vector into an output vector via a weight matrix. So the weights, weirdly, are computed from the input data itself. So Wij is a normalized version of the dot product of two embedding vectors. Okay, so you have an input word, say sun, which is represented by a vector, and you weight that vector by something that is the inner product of sun with all other words, and you sum over all the words, the index j.
Decide the dimensionality of this space.
So the embedding space's dimensionality can range from 10 to thousands. For ChatGPT, I believe it's in the thousands.
And is that about like difficulty of training versus ability to separate words or something like that?
Yep. Flexibility versus compute cost. Yeah. The bigger the embedding space, the more flexible you can be. So ChatGPT is trained on, you know, the total number of words is order 100,000. The total amount of text it's trained on is order a trillion tokens, which is words and blank spaces and punctuations. So it's got a lot of training data. So even so, it only needs an embedding dimension of order 1,000. I asked ChatGPT what its embedding dimension is, and it said, well, it basically said that's a trade secret, but based on the space of other LLMs, it's order 1,000. So this inner product is normalized. So you get a weight that's between 0 and 1 using the softmax function. Okay. So just to visualize it, you can look at, by the way, our notes are mostly just, you know, text and diagrams borrowed from the literature and various blog posts. So here's one diagram. You have two words represented by these vectors x1 and x2. You transpose one of them. You take the inner product. You get a weight. You multiply x1 by that weight, x2 by that weight, x3 by that weight, and you generate output vectors. Okay. So this is very clear, right? And all you take away is the idea that you're using sort of the cosine similarity of vectors to build relationships between words. So how do we learn? This is where the really kind of arbitrary way that deep learning works happens. So you notice that in these equations, there were three instances of the input vector x, right? If you look at these two equations, they are third order in x. So there's three occurrences. So you take each of those occurrences and multiply x by a weight matrix, let's not use the word weight here, but by another matrix, whose elements are free parameters. And that's really it. So you motivate yourself through this inner product, and then you say that, well, I need learnable parameters, so I'm going to multiply each instance of x by some big matrix, and let's not worry about the dimensions of the matrix. And I'm going to, in the training process, learn the parameters of the matrix, and that's going to get me a much better representation of these vectors.
Oh wait, sorry, Boob. Yeah, so I missed it. I missed the first step. I think, so for each word, so how do you decide, these vectors x, the location in this, high dimensional parameter space?
That itself is learned.
So okay, so that learning is a separate step then from what's being shown on this slide.
Yes. Yes. But it's part of the training of the network.
Okay.
Anything Helena or Demetrius would like to add, feel free. That's a much smaller number of free parameters.
I think I have a slide on transformers overall, as a full model later. So hopefully that will help clarify some things.
Okay. So when you read about how does a transformer work, it's going to be all about these query key and value matrices. And they're explained in some plausible sounding colloquial way, when you search for a video on YouTube, then what you type is your query, and it has inbuilt keys, and it matches keys to queries, and comes up with a similarity matrix that's multiplied by the value. I found it very difficult to get that kind of intuitive feeling. So if you look at the equations on this page and the next page, you will see that we've replaced the weight matrix by the product of the query and the key, along with some normalizing term. And so these two, this is that xi, xj dot product, now involves two learnable matrices. And there's another dimension. These matrices have their own dimensions that are usually the same. So in addition to the embedding dimension, there's now the dimension of these matrices. And let's just jump to the next slide, where in vector notation, so V, remember, is this product, another learn matrix times X. So the first two product of the X's are now the query and key, and they're normalized and multiplied by the value. And so each of these, Q, K, and V, are obtained by the matrix multiplication now of the entire input vector X with this learnable matrix to get these intermediate products. And they're all multiplied together to get what's called attention, which is the output vector. Okay, hold that thought and let's look at this diagram. The garden is blooming. Sorry, Ghazal, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, in slide number 12, you introduced the W, the capital W. So is it that now these new W's are the blocks of that or completely new matrices?
So good question. So this W, we've inserted two matrices into this equation. Xi is multiplied by the query and Xj by the query and Xi by the key. So there's two weight matrices that multiply the X's, and their product is now called the similarity matrix. So they're all learnable weights. And in case somebody's observing carefully, I'm sorry, but we've used different conventions between our paper and these slides, which I didn't update from Demetrius's original. So don't worry about where the transposes appear. So if you look at this little wij, or rather this big WIJ and this big WIJ each of them in its argument has an xi and xj, but in this case, they are now multiplied by two matrices whose elements are three parameters.
Mm-hmm. So this okay. new WQ, these are completely new parameters introduced into the problem.
Yes. Okay. And, you know, intuitively, the idea is, you know, going back to the sun is rising in the east, we can see that in this context, sun and rising and east should live nearby. But there can be, many other contexts where east lives closer to, you know, west and north and directions, or rising lives closer to you're rising out of bed. So there's many contexts in which different words have pairwise similarity. So it's hard to come up with an a priori clustering of words in this embedding space. So it learns them by being trained on all these different variations of sentences in which a pair of words appears.
Okay, thank you.
So, right. So these are words, and you come up with this pairwise connection between garden and blooming, for example, is this element. It's, you know, there's pretty strong correlation. Garden and is a pretty generic association, and so on. I'm not sure I can give much more intuition, but I'm happy to take questions, and Helen can take questions. But let's jump to another way of showing what we are doing. She is eating a green apple, eating and green, low attention, eating an apple, high attention. So these would have a stronger off-diagonal element in the covariance matrix, eating an apple, than eating and green. In this image, if you were trying to figure out whether this is a dog or not, the ears and the eyes and the mouth are obviously key pieces of identifying a dog, and their mutual relationship is important. So we'll see later how images are also broken up into patches, and the pairwise relationship of patches is learned just like sequential data is learned. Okay, so what I've described to you is called the attention mechanism, in particular the self-attention mechanism, how you build a deep learning architecture out of it. Helen's going to take you through. Helen, do you want me to go through the slides, or should I stop sharing and you'll share?
No, it's okay. If I can just say, like, next slide, please, that would be nice. Cool. So I guess this is, like, this part is like a bit of a technical detail, but we have this like attention mechanism that we just explained with like the whole query key and value matrices whole like situation. And oftentimes, just to improve or bolster the learnability of this model, or like how much different complex stuff can be learned by the model, they will sort of split up each of these like query key and value matrices into these non-overlapping portions, like is shown in this figure here on the slide. And they'll have like separate attention mechanisms operate on each of these individual pieces. And so we call each of these individual attention mechanisms a head, an attention head, and then we'll concatenate all of the attention heads together at the end. So they call it multi-headed attention. And multi-headed attention is pretty standard for, I guess, most transformer architectures. Okay, next slide. Okay, so we keep talking about transformer architectures, and hopefully this part will sort of answer Neil's question and maybe others' questions about like how this all comes together. So I guess first with the attention mechanism, it's generally encompassed in sort of like a block of like things that typically go together. So that's what I'm showing here. Typically there's a self-attention mechanism. And then after that, there's a couple other things called layer normalizations, which just normalize everything so that there's not like individual, I guess like very large numbers or very small numbers that will skew the entire whole like situation. And then there's a feed forward layer, which is what MLP stands for, multi-layer perceptron, which is just like a fancy way of showing that thing that Boob was showing at the very beginning, which is just a bunch of nodes all connecting to each other with weights. And the feed forward layer, this multi-layer perceptron is generally just a way to like inject those non-linearities that Boob mentioned earlier into the model, because we don't want it to learn just like linear relationships. We obviously, the world is very complex and we need a lot of non-linearities to model it all. So then if you go to the next slide. Yeah, so then these transformer blocks, which like you can see, for example, the blue one on the left side that says encoder on it is like exactly the same thing that I was showing on the previous slide. There's the self-attention, the layer norm, the feed forward, and then another layer norm. So like these like things typically come together. And then in like direct relationship to Neil's question earlier, like how do we get all these like embeddings and stuff? Like pretty commonly there's something called like an encoder decoder architecture in which the encoder basically takes the input and like through a bunch of really complicated in the sense of like having this like transformer block, like the attention and all this other stuff. You learn this relationship to an encoding, which is like that high dimensional vector space that Boob was talking about. And then the decoder sort of undoes those operations. And this isn't like unique to a transformer. It's actually the encoder decoder architecture is like pretty commonly used, like even in astronomy where people are like, for example, there's like a time series signal and like the goal is to be able to reconstruct the time series signal. But the reason why you would do that is that in the middle, this like encoding is like, if you are able to take this input time series signal and then encode it into like some kind of vector form and then use that vector form and have the decoder be able to reconstruct the same time series signal, that means that this encoding that you learned is actually like means something. And then there can be interesting things that you can do on that space that you wouldn't be able to do, for example, like on the input space. And like one of those examples is just like dimensionality reduction of data. So if you have like this pretty large image, maybe like 64 by 64 pixels, you can reduce that to like maybe a single vector of like maybe 32 dimensions. And then that will have like a lot of the same information because you trained it using this encoder decoder mechanism, if that makes sense. I guess we can go on to the next one. Right. And so in the context of LLMs, I guess it's important to remember that there's nothing magical about transformers or attention themselves. Attention has existed for a really long time. And transformers basically just like stripped away all of the other stuff that attention used to come with and allowed for like parallel processing to an extent that has never really been observed before in like previous types of deep learning architectures. And as a result of that, people were able to scale the amount of training data that they were giving to this model and decrease like the training time significantly. So it's actually like feasible to learn on like, for example, 10% of like the entire internet. And the reason why we're seeing like all these really amazing results recently is because they just like threw a ton of data at these models, and now the models are like billions of parameters, and like all of that stuff was not feasible before. So like it is cool, you know, obviously it's good to learn about attention in transformers, but it shouldn't be overemphasized that the like architecture is the reason for this stuff happening. It's actually data.
Can I add a comment?
Yeah, of course.
I think even the experts didn't really anticipate some of the capabilities that arose just when the training data crossed a certain threshold, you know, in log space. So the transformers enabled the training data size, and suddenly the LLM was extraordinarily good.
If no one has any more questions, then we can start talking about applications to astronomy. So I'm just going to give a couple of examples. So for a time series, these researchers, this is all like super recent work, seeing like more and more work on transformers in astronomy pop up, has like, it's like literally, I mean, it started with like one or two and now there's like 10. So I would say it's like exponential growth, but it's not like, you know, it's not on the level of like actual machine learning research, but it is pretty cool to see. I think when I was writing the time series section for this archive post that we made, I was just reading all the titles and on archive and I was like, when is this gonna end? Like, this is so much. I expected to be writing like two or three blurbs, but in fact it had to be like 15 different references. So anyway, it is very exciting, and I'm only showing like two or three examples of like all of the stuff that's already out there. But anyway, I decided to show this one because it shows off one of the training paradigms that is like pretty common in with like transformers and LLMs, but not like, definitely not specific to transformers and LLMs. So there's something called pre-training, which is back to like Sergey's question and our discussion around that, is a self-supervised type of training. So there's like no maybe you know that you have like some end goal in mind, like for these people, they specifically wanted to do like classification of variable stars, but as a precursor to doing that like supervised learning portion where you have the label for the variable star and you have the data, like a light curve, for example, they first did a pre-training step, which is following. And the way they did this is like following this one particular paper in natural language called BERT, which basically takes like an input sentence, like, I don't know, the sun is rising, whatever we've said, the sun is rising in the east, and like will mask out certain words. So it'll say like the mask is mask in the mask, or like, you know, you can mask out all of the, it doesn't have to be the nouns that are masked, but anyway, that was a random example. So they did that except for time series. So these time series of like variable star light curves. And you can see on the left, the figure 5 that I copied over here, the second like row of ones and zeros, or the first row of ones and zeros is the mask. So they're basically saying like, if something is a one, then it will stay in the input. And if something is a zero, then it'll be masked away. So basically just replaced by the zero. Basically you just multiply the inputs by the attention mask. And then that will actually be the thing that goes into your network. And then the final end product is that you want to reconstruct the things that were zeros. So you see all this, you see like clearly there's some kind of trend, and then it's like interspersed with emptiness. And so in that empty space, then the model will try to, the goal is for the model to try to reconstruct like the input values that were there. So in the sentence example, it would be obviously trying to predict the word sun and trying to predict the word rising, etc. So in this case, the right side picture is their architecture. So you can see that there's a self-attention block like we were talking about. And at the very end, and also the encoder-decoder architecture that I mentioned earlier. And then at the very end, it says reconstructed magnitude. So that's like the final product is to reconstruct those masked portions of the input. And the loss function is just like maybe mean squared error, where you just like look at the difference between the reconstructed magnitudes and like the true magnitudes of those masked away portions of the input. So that's called like the masked language modeling loss. Is like has been shown to do better when it comes to like doing downstream tasks, such as like other classification tasks or whatever, rather than just like predicting the next token, which you can see as like single directional because you're only looking forward. Whereas like if you are masking individual things in the middle, then you can consider that like you're trying to reinforce these like bi-directional relationships because there's stuff from the future and stuff from the past. I guess if you think about it in language or even in variable stars, it's like a time series. So there's stuff from the future and stuff from the past, and you can learn relationships bi-directionally. So that's what BERT stands for, actually. It's the first, the B is bi-directional. So that turns out to be a lot more powerful, although it means that you have to have like future knowledge. Yeah, feel free to go to the next slide. Right, so that was the pre-training step, and these people were interested in classification. So the next part is actually the part in which they learn the task at hand, which is called fine-tuning. And that's like, basically you're saying that pre-training, like during the pre-training step, you're, you know, tuning all of these weights, like the weight matrix, the W matrices that Boov was mentioning earlier and all the other weights in the network. And then the reason it's called fine tuning is because you just make small changes to those weights in order to do this task that you actually want to do. So in this case, it looks kind of confusing because you're like, oh, originally I was doing magnitude reconstruction, but now I'm doing like a totally different task. Like, how does that work? The way it works is that you just get rid of everything after you learn this like encoding that I was talking about earlier, which they write as representation. And then you take this representation, which is just this vector representing your input. And then you learn another type of classifier like from that input. So in this case, it's just, you know, is this a, I don't know what it was, like an AGN or like a, I don't know. I don't know anything about variable stars. R, Lie Ray, that's a variable star, right? So it's able to keep like the whole encoder part that you learned from the previous pre-training step. And then all you're doing is learning some more weights on this like small linear classifier step. So what's cool about that is that you can take these representation or these encodings that I was calling them earlier, and you can do like a bunch of different, you can potentially do a bunch of different tasks using these representations because they're just generally useful. In this case, they did classification, but you know, you could do like maybe redshift regression or like any other task that you could, that you like maybe have a small amount of labels for and that you might also be interested in, which actually decreases like the amount of training time that you have to do because you can do this like pre-training step all at once. And then you can even like distribute this trained model to like all of your friends, and they can they can do whatever task that they want with only a small amount of labeled data, because like I said earlier, it's called fine tuning because you're only making really small changes to these weights rather than training a whole huge model from scratch. So you actually need a lot less labeled data, and you also don't have to train for like crazy long, which is a pretty cool paradigm. And in the, I guess, ML literature, they call this type of paradigm a foundation model, which I guess people like to talk about a lot. And also people refer to a lot of like LLMs this way because they can do a lot of different tasks like translation or like sentiment analysis, like, is this toxic? Is this not toxic? They can do all of those things better than if you just trained a smaller model from scratch to do that particular task specifically. which is pretty cool to see, I guess, like maybe one example of a of an emergent phenomenon that people didn't expect to see, but ended up happening. Okay, next slide.
Sorry, like, yeah, this is, sorry.
Like, yeah, please go ahead.
I didn't so in this like the previous example you were showing, you know, seemed to be similar, just like in painting, you know, regions that were masked out. Then you jumped here, you know, to classifying different, types of like variable sources, you know, like, you know, so somewhere along the way, you know, was there someone like telling, like, you know, telling you that this was like our Lyrae, you know, this thing was like a supernova or.
So during the previous step, during the pre-training step, like you were talking about the masking. So that's like exactly what's happening. They're just trying to learn the parts that were masked away. And then when you move from the pre-training step to the fine-tuning step of the actual classification task, then the input data is different. So then the input data, instead of being like these masked light curves, and then the unmasked portions, obviously the unmasked portions are like the correct thing. So you need the unmasked portions as well to train. Instead of giving that, you give the full light curve, and then you give like the external source saying, this is, you know, this is a supernova, this is a blah, blah, blah. So that's what I called like label data. And that's what I meant when I said that you don't need as much labeled data, because you have already trained quite a bit. So then you can only train a small amount on like a smaller amount of labeled data, because like at least in time domain, we don't have like a whole bunch of label data, because you have to take spectra and people have to look at the spectra, and you know, it's like a whole thing. So then you change the input data, and then you also change the model, like the way that I'm showing in this example, by removing the part where you're trying to reconstruct the light curve and slotting in this classifier instead.
Okay, yeah, got it. Okay, thanks.
Okay, awesome. Okay, so finally, this example is of like basically what I was showing before, this like masked loss. But that's like exactly what they wanted. So they didn't necessarily want to do any future fine tuning. They just wanted to basically learn this trend by like denoising the like input noised light curve. So the way that they do that is pretty much exactly what I was mentioning with the masked loss prior, which is like these blue bands that you see in like the input and the predictions are the masked regions. So they just get rid of all of the signal in those regions. And then because they make the assumption that the noise is totally decorrelated from the data, then if you can remove like certain portions of the data, then the idea is that the model will learn like the overall trend of the signal while ignoring the noise, because the noise at each point is going to be like decorrelated from the overall trend. So the goal is to learn the overall trend, which is the, I guess what they're showing in the red line at the very top. So that's like a slightly different way of using these models for time series. That's what I had to talk about. And Boov can continue talking about vision transformers and galaxies and stuff.
I'll just wrap up in 2 minutes by noting that given an image, you can do a very crude thing, break it up into patches, and you know, you can average or pick the maximum. Within each patch and feed that sequence of numbers, just like you would feed a time series data, learn all the relationships within it, and do your machine learning on images that way. Remarkably, it works quite well. And again, when the training data exceeds a certain number of million images, I think it's 100 million on some generic image samples, then transformers outperform everything else, in particular CNNs. So this is my last slide, that transformers learn long-range correlations as well as they learn short-range correlations. In fact, in the attention mechanism, the location of two words or two parts of an image is not even relevant or known. So, you know, again, it is like building, when you build a covariance matrix, all pairwise correlations are computed. And so that's the reason why it may perform, outperform, say, a CNN for images, because a CNN starts local and builds outward from small scales to large scales. So it may miss some opportunities that a transformer captures right away. But the main virtue, as Helen said, is that it's practically able to rapidly train on huge amounts of data. So that's it. Thank you. This is our first attempt to talk about these nodes, so we appreciate your patience.
All right, awesome. Thanks, guys. Yeah, so why don't we give them a round of applause for their interesting talk? It's almost noon. Okay, yeah. So, is there time, you know, for some additional questions if people have any? So you can either just jump in or you can raise your hand. Oh yeah, Jesse. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So I mean, I take it from this notes, this seems like partly motivated for you guys to learn about these things. Are there any application cosmology or astrophysics that you haven't had a chance to mention that you're particularly excited about?
A student at Penn called Shubh Agarwal has been trying vision transformers to do cosmology with lensing maps and comparing them to CNNs. Still kind of early days. But Helen has a much more compelling application to time series data.
Yeah, I guess I didn't even talk about my own work, which is kind of funny. I'll try to keep this short, but like in time series, we have a whole bunch of, or in time domain astrophysics, like we have a whole bunch of unlabeled data, right? Like we, you know, observe the sky with these like telescopes all the time. But we don't really like know what we're seeing for sure, unless like we take a spectra and then we have people look at, you know, the emission lines. You guys probably know all this better than I do. But so the problem is that like, you know, when we do take these spectra, we look for like objects that are closer by or like brighter or just like better signal to noise objects. However, like the unlabeled data, there's all sorts of, you know, crazy stuff out there, like redshift one, past redshift one. And like, we definitely don't have any spectra all the way over there. So you could consider that this is a mismatch between like the labeled training data and the unlabeled test data. So like, actually you want to do well on this unlabeled data, but you don't know how to do that because you only have this like stuff that's close by. And so something that I worked on is called domain adaptation, which is like where you try to take information from this like unlabeled data set that you have that you actually want to do well on, and the information from the labeled data set, obviously. So the way that we came up with to do that is to do this pre-training that Boov is showing on the screen here, pretty much the same way that these people did it. On the full data set, so all the unlabeled data as well as the labeled data. And when I say labeled, I just mean like, for example, classification. Like we were just doing like 14 different types of time domain objects. and after that, you can do this fine tuning step, which is the next slide, which will associate like this, like what the model learned during the pre-training step with labels. So like, I guess intuitively we were thinking, you know, it'll learn representations that are kind of clustered, and then during the fine tuning step, it'll like assign labels to the clusters. So we actually found that it doesn't really work well unless you do a particular thing to the labeled data, which is that you have to make the labeled data, you have to manually make the labeled data look more like the unlabeled data, which for us is basically like these two populations differ in redshift. So we made up a redshifting augmentation where we just pretended like each object in the label data set was further away than it actually was. So we just picked a further away redshift, and then we basically simulated like what it would look like through this, you know, for example, LSST, if it were like at that further away location. And we found that that was a significant improvement over just doing the pre-training and the fine tuning. But if you get rid of any of these components, if you get rid of the pre-training step and you only take this augmented data and you just train on it like, you know, a regular supervised learning task, it also doesn't do as well. So the pre-training and the fine tuning with the augmentations like all work together to produce like the best outcome. That was a lot of info. Hopefully that made sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, like, but you guys were saying though that, you know, yeah, so these transformers really outcompete only when like the data size is like in like the hundreds of millions.
That number was for like image analysis task, I think. Yeah. Tens or hundreds. For language, it's in the billions.
In the billions, I see.
Like, okay. Order, I think somewhere between 10 and 100 billion, I think, is where like emergence appears. You know, you can ask it to write a science fiction story about squirrels living in the clouds of Venus, and it'll do perfectly good job of it, even though that's not remotely part of its training data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, okay. Okay, we're a few minutes past the hour, so why don't we stop here? Yes, thanks again, guys. Yeah, you know, this was really great. And for everyone else, yeah, like we will reconvene next week in person, I think. Okay. Yes, thanks again, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Fun.
Bye.